Hello, thank you so much for joining us yet again for another episode of What Page Are You On? It's me, Bethany Rutter, but on this occasion I'm not joined by my good friend and business partner, Alice Slater. This is an interview that I conducted with one of our truly favourite authors of the 21st century, Michelle Paver, whose new novel, Wakenhurst, is out now. And yeah, we just felt so lucky to be invited to interview her. And she turned out to be one of the most kind of interesting and warm and thoughtful and kind people that I could have hoped to meet. So if you're not familiar with her work, I would 100% recommend going back and familiarizing yourself with Thin Air and Dark Matter, which are her ghost stories. But yeah, keep listening for our chat with Michelle about Wakenhurst, which is an absolutely brilliant kind of dark gothic tale. Thanks so much. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
Can you begin by telling us a bit about Wakenhurst, which is the reason we're here today?
Yeah, well, it's a gothic novel set in the fens of Suffolk in Edwardian times. It's 1906, and my heroine, Maud, is an upper-class Edwardian child at the beginning of the story, and she's growing up in an ancient manor house in the fens. The marshlands, and her life is ruled by her father, who's intensely religious and hates women and is secretly riddled with guilt, although we don't actually know why. And one day in the graveyard he finds a painted hell, a doom as they're called, the last judgment, devils dragging sinners into hell. And that sort of jolts his guilt to the surface. Strange things start to happen. And as Maud grows up, I mean, she's only 16 at the end of the story, she has to become strong because she no longer has a mother. And her life is becoming a battle of wills with her father. Is he going mad, or is there really something out there in the fens? So it's a sort of heady brew, of superstition and folklore and demons and ghosts, with a rather strong female character at the heart.
And this book is slightly different, or quite different, to the last two books you've written for adults, which are Thin Air and Dark Matter.
Yeah.
Why did you change direction now? Because those are very explicitly kind of ghosty, whereas this is something else. I don't know exactly.
Yes.
It is straight up
it's sort of
classic gothic.
I mean, the working title I had for it was Gothic, rather than Wakenhurst all the way through. It's a strange thing as to where stories come from, and I'm sure you know yourself. The Dark Matter and Thin Air were very much completely male cast of characters, because, you know, only men tended to go up to the Arctic for Dark Matter in the 1930s or climb the Himalayas in Thin Air. I'd always wanted to write a story set in the fens. I mean, my very first published novel, a historical novel called Without Charity, had a Fenland element in it. And the research I'd done for that was, I just thought, wow, this is an amazing sort of liminal world. You know, it's neither land nor water. Lots of demons and ghosts associated with it, and malaria and hallucinations. And as I was writing the previous book, Thin Air, I was mulling over the fens, and for some reason I knew it was going to be a female protagonist. I mean, it could just be as simple as, you know, I've written two ghost stories with all male characters and I wanted to write about a woman. But I think it was also having some chats with my mother, who's 88, and my elderly aunt, who's 91. They're Belgian, both, you know, sharp as tacks. But over a couple of glasses of wine, just in the last few years, they started telling me stuff about their side of the family, particularly the women, my great-grandma. And she had such a tough life because she had a pretty horrible husband. You know, the man was boss in those days. And he had an absolute right to have sex with her whenever he wanted. She had seven children and lost three of them to diphtheria in 1 week, sort of thing. And her, one of her daughters who survived was my grandmother. So there was a lot of that, I think, which was mulling around. And, you know, my mother and aunt would tell me things that, frankly, I hadn't heard before. Little things letting slip. he didn't like children, but he liked making them.
Mm.
Was one phrase that my aunt sort of produced, and all this came together in Wakenhurst.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds quite a bit like the father character. And
oh yes,
yeah,
yes. I mean, a lot of him is based on some of my less than savoury great grandfathers and uncles and things on the Belgian side. Because you know, when I was researching it, in the Edwardian times, you know, life was stacked against you as a woman. I mean, Maud is okay; she's upper class, so she doesn't have to worry about food and things. But she only has two choices in life, and that's to be a wife or an old maid. And she's not very pretty, and she's very isolated, so she's probably going to be an old maid. And she just wants to be free. So freedom is a big theme in the book, and you know, there are images of wings, and there's a magpie on the cover of Wakenhurst because she rescues a magpie, and he becomes a sort of symbol of freedom to her as well.
But also a kind of bad omen, like magpies to us are like, absolutely. If I see a magpie, yeah. I think bad luck.
Well, a lot of people do. There's a lot of folklore surrounding magpies, some good, a lot of it bad. And I do explore that in the book. I mean, that was partly also based on, you know, I rescued a magpie, just as Maud does, and it made a big impression on me. You know, I'd left a bucket of water in the alleyway, and he fell in and was nearly drowning, and I found him and got him cleaned up at a wildlife sanctuary and then let him go. And, I mean, he didn't come back and sort of be grateful because they're wild animals, but it did make a huge impression on me. So a lot of, you know, rather like a magpie, you know, writers, as you know, sort of pick things, and if they make an impression on them, at some point they'll use them.
Yeah, a kind of assemblage of
exactly
different elements.
Iron filing sort of gathering around a magnet, and the magnet in this case is Maud. She's the sort of beating heart of the story. It's her story and how she deals with this supposedly crazy or perhaps haunted father.
But another kind of big character in it is the Fens, as you said.
Yes.
So how are you from around there? How did they kind of appear to you?
I have no family connection to the Fens whatsoever. The Palers came from Yorkshire originally. But looking back, I mean, I have had a connection with, you know, East Anglia as a very small child. Well, if you know, interpret it widely, including sort of parts of Cambridgeshire as well. As a small child, we went down Grimes Grade. And this is in the 60s when, you know, health and safety wasn't it really. It was a rusty ladder, and you went into these sort of mines dug by the Stone Age people. And going to Ely on a school trip made a big impression on me. You know, it's called the Ship of the Fens, the cathedral. You suddenly see it sort of rising up. And there's some extremely gothic carvings in Ely Cathedral, you know, devils and things. And then, of course, the ghost stories of M.R. James, which I read as a teenager. And he, you know, a lot of his stories are based in East Anglia. So that was always there with a supernatural connection, a gothic connection. It was just finding the right story to tell. And then, you know, that came about really within a matter of a few weeks. You know, I'd had been having these discussions with my mother and my aunt, but then I picked up a book in an Oxfam second-hand bookshop by a 15th century mystic I'd never heard of before, a woman called Marjorie Kemp, and it was so bizarre. I thought, I've got to use this somehow. I mean, the poor woman, you know, she'd been married at 14, had 14 kids, not surprisingly had gone off sex, and then had a sort of religious conversion, cried for hours on end. So in today's terms, she was probably experiencing some sort of depressive condition. And then, you know, that was one thing. So I thought, oh, I've got to use this. And then I read about the Wenniston Doom, which was this sort of painted picture, medieval painting of devils dragging sinners into hell that was whitewashed by the Puritans, forgotten in a church for 300 years. Victorians came along, decided to do up the church and chucked it out, and they were going to burn it the next day. And that night there was a storm, and the rain washed away some of the whitewash. And so a parish clerk was standing in the graveyard, and he saw this painting staring up at him. And when I read that, I just thought, oh gosh, I can just see this man who later became Maud's father, with a painted eye staring up at him accusingly, you know, and that became a pivotal scene in Wakenhurst. And then the other thing, that the third sort of element, which again was just the next week, was going to an exhibition of the Victorian artist Richard Dadd, who painted these really weird, otherworldly paintings with lots of little animals, or people, fairies, whatever. And he painted them in Broadmoor because he killed his father with an axe. So I thought, I've got to do something.
Yeah, that is like, that's a very kind of strange...
It's really strange, within literally about 3 weeks, and that doesn't often happen with me. But I thought, how can I link the paintings with the doom? And that is eventually became the story of Wakenhurst. I won't say any more about the story, but Maud, when she came together, then everything started to crystallise, because I had to have the central character.
Yeah, because that was something else I kind of wanted to ask you about, was that they're not, it feels like you're kind of... ghost and gothic novels, they're not just kind of fantastic versions of those genres, but they are like kind of character studies. What do you have a system, like what comes first, the person you want to write about or the world you want to write about or the ghosty thing you want to tell?
That's an amazing question, which no one's ever asked me, which is lovely. That's a very writerly question. It's a bit like leapfrogging. It's kind of the one comes a little bit and then the other comes. And, I mean, I had a series of impressions. I sort of knew, because of the Wenniston Doom, this painting of devils dragging sinners into hell, I knew that devils would come into it somewhere. But as you say, I'm not a fantasy writer. I can't write about ghosts or spirits unless there is also a psychological... explanation.
Because isolation or...
Yes, isolation. I mean, in the Arctic, Dark Matter, that ghost story, you know, my protagonist is either up there with a ghost or he's suffering from extreme isolation in the thin air. You know, he's up a mountain, so there's altitude sickness. In this one, there's all sorts of things that could be playing with people's mind. In the father's case, is guilt surfacing after decades. So I do like to sort of know fairly early on what the psychological problem is, but it's not something I can sort of say, right, now what's this year's psychological problem I'm going to explore? It's actually got to come up from the subconscious. I've kind of got to let that arise, as it were, rise to the surface. Lots of watery images coming into this. And what I tend to do is I do a lot of reading around the subject, you know, reading about medieval attitudes to death and Edwardian attitudes to death and the afterlife, folklore of the Fens, and that tends to throw things up and some things. I mean, witchcraft, there's a slight element of witchcraft in it, but it tended not to... I kept sort of pushing it to one side. It wasn't really what this was about.
Yeah.
It's quite a laborious way of doing it. Because, you know, you tend to do a lot of research around the subject before you think... I realise, you know, yes, this is where I'm going. And I have to say, I had some false starts with it. And, in fact, I wrote about sort of 100 pages of the beginning. And then I woke up one morning at 3 a.m. and I thought, you're making it too complicated. And I actually wrote a note to myself and said, look, this Wakenhurst is about Maud and Edmund, you Burke, you know, so...
Get rid of the rest of it.
And it went in the recycling bin.
Yeah.
And
which is really hard to do. I feel like to kind of scrap what is hours of work is hard, but maybe necessary.
It's hard, but actually it was a good moment, you know, because what I hate is when I know it's not quite working and I keep sort of tinkering with the prose, but it's a bit like sort of tidying up the wallpaper where you know that the structure isn't right. So, yeah... keeping it simple in that sense, because it's quite a complicated story, but keeping it, you know, it is a two-hander between Maud and her father. It is a battle of wills.
Yeah. It's kind of a slightly banal question, but like, how do you research stuff like this? Whenever I read something like this or Dark Matter, and it's kind of so dense with place and time and these funny little details that I just think, how does she know? You know, I totally believe that this is... what it was like, or that they would have this thing in this room.
Yeah.
But like, how do you know? Like, how do you research this stuff?
It is tricky. And it's not systematic. That's the one thing, you know. I'm not an historian, so I don't have to be systematic. There are vast lacunae, to use another, you know, watery metaphor, in my knowledge. But with something like Wakenhurst, there's some book research. And I mean, not being a millennial, I do tend to not do masses of research on the internet. The only internet research I did quite, you know, the sort of exorcism rites of by the Catholic Church, that's all readily available, you know, on the internet, so fine. But you've got to check the Latin there a few times. So, you know, I don't really trust the internet that much. British Library, I drove past it on the way to this interview, and that is one of my favourite places.
Yeah.
So that's just a real treat. And they have a great tea room as well with cake, which is good. So, and you know, I think the thing about the book research is sometimes you don't know what's going to come up from the stacks, and that can be really interesting, and also just haunting secondhand bookshops, because I think it's mentioned in the author's notes in Wakenhurst, some really useful books I just happened on in a secondhand bookshop in York. There was a sort of poacher's memoirs, and that gave me, there's a whole scene in the book, quite a romantic scene, when Maud and the young undergardener she's in love with go eel babbing.
Yes.
You know, well, I didn't know anything about eel babbing, but this poacher's memoirs taught me what I needed to know about eel babbing. And so that's an element of chance again.
So it's just kind of being open-minded, looking for one thing.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
Exactly. And thinking, you know, country memoirs. I knew I was going to be writing a book about Edwardian country folk of all classes, and, you know, fine, you pick that up. Secondhand bookshops are really useful from that sort of thing. But you can only go so far. I can only go so far with books. And so I do like my location research. You know, obviously I went to the Arctic for dark matter and up the Himalayas for thin air. Suffolk, somehow, yeah. Slightly easier. Stay
cheaper,
lovely.
More manageable.
Absolutely, 14th century pub and all that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, the Fens, as you perceptively said, is a character in the story, and so I really wanted that atmosphere to be, I wanted it to be soaked in that atmosphere. I wanted you to be able to smell it and feel it and feel that you're there. So I went there. I mean, only pockets of the Fens, the real Fens exist now, but lots of marshes, splashed through them in all weathers. Waterproof notebook, very useful, because I do, you know, I don't have a very good memory, so I jot down impressions there and then. I went, you know, in the dark on a particularly haunted common, according to the, you know, true hauntings books that I picked up, again, in yeah. Secondhand bookshops. That happened to be Halloween, in thick sea fog, trying to perhaps see a ghost.
There can be no better day to do research for this
totally.
Book.
I mean, it was wonderful. I didn't have any, you know, supernatural experiences. I don't think I'm a sensitive or on that wavelength, but certainly, you know, just hearing the reeds rustling and thinking you saw things. And then, you know, that sort of research can give you little things that you don't even know will be important. Like, you know, I was trudging back to the pub one evening, and one of those great big flocks of starlings started up, you know, and I watched it from just a few birds for about half an hour to one of these great big murmurations. And I didn't know at the time, but that became a real image for Maud of freedom, and it was fantastic, you know, and it was completely on my own. That's something I do, you know, if anyone's listening who's trying to write, I think doing that sort of research on your own, it allows you to just really be with your characters.
Yeah, and it's almost like experience it as they might, rather
absolutely.
Than in relation to whatever weird conversation you're having with your friend.
Absolutely, you know, the nicest, the best friend possible. And it's going to distract you. I mean, I also obviously went to see the Wenaston Doom, the one I mentioned that was rediscovered in the churchyard, which is in a beautiful little Suffolk church. Rather worryingly, you know, I was allowed, I mean, it's just at ground level, and there were sort of plastic chairs in front of it. I could have touched this thing, you know. It was extraordinary. And that's one of the things I love about England. You know, you can go, and there was a little sign saying, please close the door of the church, otherwise jackdaws fly in.
Yeah.
Which is a lovely little
atmospheric
touch.
Yeah, because I didn't exactly know how to. For all you described it in the book, I didn't know what a doom was necessarily.
Yes.
But I just kind of imagined it as like a Bruegel painting, or you know, something it's, kind of chaotic and
it's
sinister.
A bit like that. Yeah. Yes. I mean, they vary tremendously, but there's usually Christ at the top, and then there's St. Michael sort of defending the. Well, I'm not a Christian, so you know, I'm not getting it right particularly, but that there are some happy sinners going up to heaven, and then there are lots and lots of happy people, dead people going up to heaven, and then lots and lots of sinners howling and being dragged and often tortured into hell. I mean, personally, I think the whole point of it was to say, look, jolly well toe the line, peasants.
Yeah.
Otherwise, this is what's going to happen to you. It's all about power. Not a very nice thing to have in front of you when you're going to church, but that's what they did.
Yeah. Not a kind of joyful, empowered approach to religion and choice.
It was very, very doom-laden, and you are a miserable sinner, and, you know, you've got to toe the line, particularly if you're a woman, I think,
yeah,
in those days, and right up until recently. I mean, all this research really made me just so glad to be a woman in the UK living now and not then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who do you like to read?
Ooh, who do I like to read?
Or what do you like to read?
Yes, I do vary. I tend to have sort of, I go along little avenues or themes. I read a lot of 19th century novelists. I like Trollope and the Brontes. I do like Jane Austen as well. And I also like the sort of 1930s and 40s female writers and 50s. Elizabeth Taylor.
Yes, I love her.
I really love the way she writes. I love her short stories. I love Edith Wharton as well, and Henry James, but Edith Wharton, well, I think she wrote the most wonderful ghost stories and beautifully elegant prose. And a lot of these women writers, I read them on two levels. I love the style and the clarity of the writing, the perception, but also there's an element of social history. You know, if you're reading Edith Wharton, she was just effortlessly part of the upper classes in old New York, and so she writes with total conviction about that because she lived like that. Elizabeth Taylor wrote about the home counties in the sort of 1940s and 50s when women, they didn't seem to do anything,
yeah,
you know, except worry about the servants and,
yeah,
and their relationships with
potter
them.
Around
yes and potter around. What do they do all day?
Yeah.
You know, and I find that fascinating. Barbara Pym is another one.
Yeah, I really like this. She's so funny
and so incisive, but in a very unassuming way. I think she's wonderful. And Molly Keane, the Irish writer who wrote originally as J.G. Farrell, she's slightly darker and more trenchant. And what a girl she was, because she grew up in this sort of hunting, fishing, shooting Irish aristocracy who wouldn't be seen dead holding a book. And she wrote these amazing novels, you know. So I also like biographies of writers.
Yeah.
I love them. I mean, Hermione Lee's biographies of Edith Wharton and Virginia Woolf are just superb. I've read them several times. And there's a wonderful one of E. Nesbitt, and I can't remember who wrote it, but she had an amazing life, you know. And as a writer, I find it fascinating to see, you know, how much of themselves they put into their books and how they dealt in E. Nesbitt's case with, she had an appalling husband who, well, I thought he was appalling.
Yeah.
He sort of womanised and, you know, brought his mistress into her household and all this kind of thing. And it's just fascinating. How on earth did they manage? I find that quite astonishing. There I am, bleating because, you know, my shower doesn't work or something.
Yeah.
And I live completely on my own, and that's how I like it. And they had to deal with husbands and children's mistresses and things.
Yeah. So, do you read a lot of kind of ghosty things?
Oh, I do. And it tends to be a certain time of the year, and then I can't do anything else. So I'm always trying to, you know, haunting secondhand bookshops just to see what turns up. In fact, I did a stock signing. When you go around bookshops, this was in London on Monday, you go around bookshops, you sign whatever copies of Wakenhurst they've got. And at the end, I dipped into Charing Cross, one of the secondhand bookshops there, and I found two stonkingly huge old volumes of ghost stories. So I staggered home with these things. But they had ghost stories I hadn't read. You know, by some of the, you know, authors I knew. But yes, I have quite a large collection of ghost stories. And then also a sort of subset of the true hauntings, as it were. You know, sometimes a little local publications written by someone local who's just interested. And I think that's fascinating. Absolutely. I love it.
Because, yeah, I mean, I would say that Dark Matter is one of the scariest books I've read. I actually listened to it on audio, but I didn't read it as a book. I listened to it as an audio book, which I feel kind of added. So I don't know. I've never read it in paper form, but I just thought that would be a fun thing to listen to. And I just was, yeah, genuinely quite kind of terrified and looking over my shoulder and didn't like to listen to it while I was walking home on my own. And
even though it's
you know, it's not set in kind of Walthamstow of 20 whatever year it was, it was highly improbable that anything that was happening to this man was happening to me. But just something about it was so genuinely terrifying. So what scares you, like what kind of ghost stories have you read? So for me, even as someone who really likes that and wants to be scared in that way again, what can I read?
Well, of course, Emma James. I think one of the ones that scared me most of his, if anyone is new to M.R. James, I mean, he's an Edwardian writer, so, you know, there's a certain amount of careful wording and you have to sort of get used to his style, but Whistle and They'll Come to You, My Lad.
I've only seen the TV version of that, which is very scary.
Is that the one with John Hurt or the previous one, that the one with the old one?
The black and white one,
That's a superb adaptation. Yeah, by Jonathan Miller. Whistle and They'll Come to You, I think, is a superb ghost story. But there are other writers. As I said, Edith Wharton wrote some marvellous ghost stories, which there's one, her last story actually is called All Souls. It's about an old lady, upper class of course, who's finds herself alone in her house, which is snowed in, at night, and she's broken her ankle and her servants have mysteriously left. And it's as much about the sort of paranoia of extreme old age as it is about ghosts, but it's really scary. And then there was a wonderful writer called Algernon Blackwood, who was an English writer, but he travelled a lot as a sort of backwoodsman in Canada, and he wrote about the sort of spirits and the ghosts of the great outdoors, which is quite unusual. And he in some of his best stories he evoked that sort of dread of being in a forest and not knowing what's around you, in really beautifully. So I think those, and then you probably know Shirley Jackson,
The
Haunting of Hill House, which I think, you know, in terms of full length ghost stories is the model of the haunted house story, with an amazing heroine.
And obviously it's quite, you know, if your project is a ghost story which is also probably based in psychology rather than supernatural, that is exactly what the Haunting of Hill House is.
That's probably why I think it's so brilliant. And the character, the central character, I think she's called Eleanor, is such an amazing. She's had this, you know, miserable life. She's looked down on by her married older sister, and her mother was pretty nasty to her. She just wants to be on her own.
Yeah, it's like she has no place in the world. That kind of America of that day didn't have a place for her to just be and
absolutely there
work
was no
and
place
relax.
For her. Yeah, and, you know, as she's driving too, because she volunteers to go and be in this haunted house. I think she just passes this little cottage or this little house, and it just speaks to her as, oh, that's what I want. And I found it heartbreaking because it really wasn't much that she wanted.
Just to be left alone.
Just to be left alone with a little place of her own, without people telling her what to do all the time. It's not asking much, but that really resonated with me. And the interesting thing is, it did when I was a sort of miserable, depressed 16-year-old, and then a miserable, depressed 30-year-old sort of being a lawyer and not enjoying it. And then I read it last year when I thankfully wasn't miserable and depressed, but it's still, there was still something there, and it's got a shocking ending, which I won't say, but nevertheless it's a satisfying ending, I think.
Yeah.
So that, if anyone hasn't read The Haunting of Hill House, it's brilliant. And I know there's a long series on TV or something, I haven't watched it, but the original book is
well worth reading.
And so, very frightening.
Yeah, no, it is. So you mentioned being an unhappy lawyer. What is your path to being an author? Because I think that's really interesting, because I think there is this perception that, like, you are either born an author or you become it. Yeah, like, you.
Yeah.
If you don't do it when you're very young, like, it's never going to happen.
And also, I think the newspapers, for good reason, tend to only report the amazing stories.
Yeah.
Where someone gets a five-figure book deal at Oxford, you know, or university. Fantastic, good on them. But no, that was not the path for me. I mean, I had always wanted to write since I was a kid, a small child, and I had written stories, and I wrote them I think I realised the power of writing stories when I was at school. I went through about a year when I was at a girls' school, and I was bullied. They all ganged up on me, and being a sort of well-bred little girls, there was no physical bullying, but you know, girls can be very, very nasty. So I was very isolated, and I'd had this tragically short haircut, so they all called me Cave Boy, you know, which was a bit prescient given Wolf Brother, but. And I really realised then, because I would make stories up, and they helped. They made me feel better. But I didn't think I could make a living out of it. And then I was at Oxford studying biochemistry, and really arrogant, actually. I thought, you know, with the arrogance of youth, I've read lots of books, I'm going to make some money. I shall write a Mills and Boon.
I mean, how hard could it be?
Yeah. How hard could it be? I hadn't even had a boyfriend yet, but I was writing romance, you know. 3 weeks, dashed it off. I think I've got it somewhere still. And, of course, it got rejected. So,
because it turns out it is harder than one would imagine.
Mills and Boon, I think, are really hard because there's very, very strict guidelines and everything. And thankfully, I realised pretty soon that I wasn't actually keen on writing Mills and Boon. So, you know, I tried to write another novel. And one of those novels, which didn't get published, was the prototype of Wolf Brother. So, you know, moral, keep everything you've ever written because you might reread it 23 years later, as I did, and it'll, you know, become something. But by then, you know, I wanted to get published. And if you'd asked me, I'd have just said, well, I just do. I just want to get published, you know. So I went on writing. I could never bring myself to write short stories, so it was a pretty laborious process because, you know, I'd write a novel, which would take a few years, because I had to get a job, you know, to pay the bills. So, you know, in my sort of other existence, I became a lawyer as a very sort of, you know, off-the-cuff decision. You know, I thought, well, I'm no good in the laboratory, so I'm quite good at exams, so I become a lawyer. Meanwhile, writing in my spare time. Well, good luck with that, because you don't get any spare time as a lawyer, you know. And I was a litigator. So, you know, big mistake to do something you don't enjoy for such a long time. I was a litigator for 13 years. But all that time, I was, well, when I wasn't, you know, having a boyfriend and, you know, trying to deal with him, various difficult men, I was writing and trying to enter literary competitions as well, which I never won, but the last one, and getting rejected, of course, but the last literary prize I entered, I didn't win. I got shortlisted, and a few weeks later, one of the judges, who was an editor at Transworld, got in touch with me and said, look, you're not there yet, but you're quite good, so send me the next thing you've written.
And that's quite a good motivator, I feel,
huge,
is having something
huge
to work towards, and a person that you know is almost like...
Exactly.
I mean, I'm sure they're not refreshing their email waiting for something from, you know, anyone in particular, but just knowing that there's someone that will care...
Absolutely.
...and is interested is very motivating.
And also, you see, I didn't know anyone in publishing. I didn't know any authors. So this was like a voice from another planet.
Yeah.
Because I used to go into bookshops and think, who are these people?
Where do they come from?
How do they get published? Are they a different species from me? You know. So I did send it to her. And at that stage, just by chance, I happened to meet the man who became my agent, because he was a client of a colleague of mine. So we sort of hooked up at the same time. And by this stage, I was getting very miserable in my job. My father had died after 5 years of cancer, and so that had sort of... I was very close to him, and that had forced a sort of re-evaluation of my life. And I thought, for Christ's sake, you know... So I don't know if I can say that, but...
you can say whatever you like.
Oh, thank you. You know, if I keep doing this, sending the book off, you know, the latest book, and getting rejected while I'm writing, I'm going to be 95 and I'm still going to be doing something I hate. So I took a deep breath and resigned. And... I'd been working about 3 months, working out my notice period, when I got my first publishing deal. So, you know, it took, I think it was 16 years from start that first Mills and Boon to getting that first publishing deal, which was the first published book was Without Charity, a historical novel. So it's a long time. And I don't want to, I hope I'm not sort of discouraging any people who are trying to write, because some people do it much quicker.
Yeah,
there is no one answer. But in a way, I mean, I'm very glad it did happen like that in a way, because I had some chance to get a bit of experience, Plus, the legal training is quite useful when you're dealing with contracts and deadlines and difficult people. So that's how it came about.
But you very much have not stuck to writing one thing over your career. You have written for adults and children.
I suppose I have, although I always sort of hum and haw when I think about it. I mean, because to me there is a sort of a theme all the way through. Perhaps not so much the first five historical novels were historical novels with a sort of strong love element, but there were all creeping in were little elements of the supernatural, and they always had a very strong sense of place and the natural world. I think it was with Wolf Brother and those books that I began to really get down to the things that I like, and to me it really doesn't matter whether it's for children or adults, because actually a lot of adults read the Wolf Brother books. It's about the natural world and about how people interpret what's going on around them. You know, I don't really believe in ghosts, but I do believe in the possibilities of the human brain, you know, hallucinations, whatever you want to call it, myths, legends, ghosts, demons. That's what I tend to get excited about.
And that's what your readers get excited about. And I really hope that people enjoy Wakenhurst as much as I and Alice, my co-host who cannot be here today, enjoyed it. Would you like to tell us where people can buy it, which is everywhere, I guess? It's published by Head of Zeus.
It's published by Head of Zeus, and it's got a great big magpie on the cover with blood spatters, so it's quite a recognisable book. It's called Wakenhurst. Yes, it's in Waterstones and Blackwells and Foyles and those good places.
And it's out right now.
And it's out right now. And it's in hardback at the moment, but it'll be in paperback, I think, in November.
And we'll probably make an amazing audiobook, so maybe I will be listening to it again.
The audiobook is out, actually, and is beautifully read. So, I am proud of it, and I hope it gives you a pleasurable thrill and makes you pleasurably frightened to look out of the window at night.
It does indeed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, Bethany. Thank you.
We'll see you all next time. Bye.